Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, let's look at some debt-related news and facts for this week. The publisher of Reader's Digest, America's most popular general interest magazine, said last Monday it will be seeking bankruptcy protection. Also, last week was not a good week for fashion. The luxury German fashion house Escada put its U.S. unit into Chapter 11 protection, while women's ready-to-wear designer Ellen Tracy was hit with an involuntary bankruptcy litigation filing by several creditors. As Daily Bankruptcy Review reported last Monday, Escada USA, Inc.'s Chapter 11 filing on Friday followed parent company Escada kicking off insolvency proceedings in Munich the prior Thursday after a failed debt exchange with its bondholders. The move will help both arms of the design house, known for its red carpet appropriate gowns, restructure in concert. Also, four creditors owed $3.8 million sought to push New York clothing maker Ellen Tracy LLC into Chapter 7 bankruptcy. In court papers, the creditors, China Mine Trading and Excellent Jade LTD of Hong Kong and Shanghai Mandarin Fashion LTD and Shanghai K&J Apparel Company of China, accused Ellen Tracy of not paying its debts as they came due. The company, whose clothes have been showcased on such supermodels as Cindy Crawford and Christy Turlington, carried in stores like Bloomingdale's, has 20 days to contest the filing. Ellen Tracy, founded in 1949 as a blouse company, was acquired from Liz Claiborne, Inc. last year by a group of investors. Liz Claiborne, Dow Jones Newswires previously reported, decided to part with Ellen Tracy after completing a strategic review of the brand. And from SeekingAlpha.com comes the article of Banking Crisis of Historic Proportions. It states that with everyone convinced that we have stepped back from the edge of the abyss, the title of this article may be viewed as laughable. When you connect the dots, as will be done in this article, you will at least stop laughing and maybe realize that we still have a big problem. We have a confluence of five factors that have the potential to create damage to banking not seen in 80 years, and that includes the Great Depression. So we'll look at these factors one at a time. The first factor is that banks are not doing enough business. Commercial bank credit growth has dropped to 2%, according to Jesse's Cafe Americaine. Now, it's a good thing that banks are conserving capital, since they need to increase capital to offset bad loans. But if asset valuations deteriorate, and it is quite possible, the banks need to increase earnings to earn their way out of the problem. Interest paid by the Fed for reserves on deposit there by the commercial banks are not producing nearly the same level of income as new credit issued commercially under our fractional reserve banking system with much higher interest. If credit issuance does not increase year over year, banks cannot improve their financial condition unless the quality of their existing loan portfolio improves. Just the opposite is anticipated for loan portfolios. So the first factor in this perfect storm is that banks are not doing enough business. The second factor in the article is that banks are falling at a rate not anticipated 2 months ago. Bloomberg indicates that 150 banks are in trouble. Some of these will be larger than many of the 77, mostly community banks, that have gone under FDIC receivership so far in 2009. Banks mentioned as being in trouble by Bloomberg include Wisconsin's Marshall and Isley Corp., Georgia's Synovus Financial Corp., Michigan's Flagstar Bank Corp., Chicago-based Chorus Bankshares, Austin-based Guaranty Financial Group, and Alabama's Colonial Bank Group. These six banks became five at the close of business on August 14th, as Colonial Bank Group was taken over by the state of Alabama and the FDIC. On July 5th, Bill Casile wrote that he projected 125 bank failures for 2009 and 230 in 2010. However, as of that date, Bill projected 82 closings by 9/30, and we have already reached 77 by August 14th. We still have half the quarter to go. With the 150 additional banks estimated by the Bloomberg article and the 77 already closed thus far this year, we could be closer to 230 closings in 2009 than the 125 estimated just 6 weeks ago. Not only have bank failure rates spiked, the current annualized rate would be in a virtual three-way tie for the second highest in history if maintained for another 9 months. And a lot of the banks going under are a lot larger than the average savings and loan in the previous crisis. According to About.com, between 1986 and 1995, over 1,000 banks with total assets of over $500 billion failed. Even if the current crisis falls far short of the 1,000 bank total, the total assets involved will still be vastly larger. Just in the failures of Wachovia Bank and Washington Mutual, the total assets were $619 billion. Add to that the IndyMac failure and the six banks in the troubled list just mentioned, and there is another $164 billion. And this does not even include the shadow banks, Merrill, Bear Stearns, Lehman, and AIG, for example, which add hundreds of billions more. There should be no false comfort taken in the prospect that we may have far fewer bank failures this time compared to the S&L crisis. The dollar amounts are likely to be many times larger. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. I've been talking about the five factors of banking crisis of historic proportions, and I'm on factor number three. The third factor is defaults are going to increase for several more quarters. With home mortgage foreclosure rates remaining very high and possibly increasing, and with the bulk of the commercial real estate defaults yet to come, the failure of banks is likely to increase in the next 9 to 12 months, not decline. The situation will be compounded if commercial and industrial loans are also default at a higher rates because of the weak or non-existent recovery. Reading some of the latest quarterly reports for a number of banks, commercial and industrial loan portfolios have generally been performing better than many other categories, but will that continue? There is an article by Jeffrey Bernstein published in late May, which is entitled C&I Loans Are Starting to Unravel, which discuss the status of a wide variety of loan portfolio categories. C&I defaults may, at this time, be like an iceberg with 90% still not visible above the water. Default rates in all credit areas have started to rise, although some have yet to reach the levels of other recent recessions. Residential mortgage defaults have been the elephant in the room. We have to continue to worry about that problem, which may increase further, but we better also worry about all the baby elephants. We may have saved the financial system, but it seems likely that we will lose banks at levels far exceeding anything seen in our history, even if we fall short in the number of approximately 1,000 S&Ls, the assets involved will be much larger. We need a large recovery to prevent disaster. We need a couple of years at 4% or higher GDP growth to have any chance that some of these banks can earn their way out of the quagmire. It is not probable that this type of economic growth can be realized. It certainly is not going to happen if commercial bank credit growth doesn't expand drastically and quickly. Now, the fourth factor is that the FDIC is in trouble. Rolf Winkler points out that the accelerating rate of bank failures may exhaust the deposit insurance fund at the FDIC, requiring that agency to draw on its credit line with the Fed. Rolf calculates that the FDIC is currently on the hook for $8.3 trillion in insured deposits, had only $41.5 billion in reserves as of March 31st, and has drawn that lower since. Since only a small portion of deposits actually are paid out of DIF, failed banks have assets that cover most deposits, FDIC needs only a small fraction of covered deposits in reserve. However, less than 0.05% is most likely several-fold too small in a distressed banking system. The section title says the FDIC is in trouble. That is a polite way of saying they are bankrupt. The final factor, the fifth factor, is we may be going to historic lows in bank credit. Because we are approaching the one-year anniversary of a growth spike in bank credit in September 2008, there is likely to be continued pressure on the year-over-year growth rate. The year-over-year growth of credit may be driven much lower than the current 2% within the next couple months due to the negative effect on comparison because of the spike a year earlier. There is one possible piece of good news here. Looking at a longer history from the Fed database, the current situation is similar to those seen after the end of recessions of 1973 to 75, 1990 to 91, and 2001. A similar minimum was also reached in 1997. It should be noted that several minima in commercial bank credit have occurred that were not associated with the end of a recession. This indicates that there are non-recessionary factors related to dips in commercial credit. All recessions have dips in commercial bank credit, but all dips in commercial bank credit are not associated with recessions. This time, the minimum may not have been reached yet because of the spike in credit volume in September 2008. If September 2009 does see a minimum in commercial bank credit, this would be another sign that the recession probably ended earlier in the year. However, the banks need far more than an end to the recession. They need a recovery of unlikely proportions. One cautionary note, although the minimum was much higher in 1981-82 recession, the lowest point occurred about a year before the recession actually ended. That could always happen again. So is there any hope? Well, since so many people are predicting a weak recovery, that has a good chance of not happening, based on the observation that in economic matters, agreement by a majority is often wrong. So if the majority is wrong, which way do you think things will go? Back into recession? The robust recovery predicted by only a few? Based on all the factors that can be collected, an advance in real GDP of 4-5% in 2010 and 2011 of 2-2.5% per year seems to be the very best that might be obtained, but less is more likely. Without a strong recovery, there is little hope of a good outcome for the non-oligarchy banks. With a return to recession in 2010 and possibly 2011 and 12, there could be carnage in regional and local banks not seen since the early 1900s and maybe even worse than what occurred then. So in sum, we are still looking at some very serious indications of a crisis in banking of historic proportions. So with that aside, let's move on to the second segment of the show and discuss some practical points for you to understand in terms of your financial situation. As is always, I start out with an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in these programs are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors and I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. Also, just to remind you that you can always get a review of all of the shows, which build on each other, from the archives at www.kruufm.com. Go into Life and Debt, and you can listen to any of the prior shows. Over the last several weeks, I have been talking about what we should not do when we are in serious financial difficulty or approaching it fast, so we don't make any mistakes over months or even years as our debt is increasing or the creditors are coming after us and we are insolvent or nearly insolvent and would eventually need to file bankruptcy. I discussed Chapter 7 bankruptcy in several shows, which you can certainly go back and listen to. That would give you a broad overview of the general principles and process of a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. In short, it's a liquidation kind of bankruptcy where consumers can get fresh starts. For most people, it's simple and it is an offering of a discharge to the vast majority of all the debt they have, while, again, in most circumstances, people do not lose any substantial amount of assets that they might own due to exemption laws and the fact that a consumer in that posture normally doesn't have much anyway other than bare necessities. As I mentioned, if someone is like about 70% of all the people who are in trouble, they would file a Chapter 7 or straight bankruptcy, sometimes called a liquidation bankruptcy. It's essentially a clean the slate kind of bankruptcy where most of the debts are completely erased, except of course for a number of debt types that are non-dischargeable. As is usually the case, by the time you actually hit the bankruptcy scenario, you do not have much that you're going to lose in a bankruptcy. If there was something that was not exempt, the trustee, of course, would then liquidate those assets and take that money. And based on proofs of claims that your creditors submit to the trustee, will pay those creditors a proportion of what is owed to the creditor. Everything that is deficient is, of course, wiped out. There's not enough money to pay it. You are no longer personally responsible. So that, in a nutshell, is the Chapter 7 kind of bankruptcy. Again, you can go back and listen to other shows to get a more detailed understanding. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Let's now talk a little bit about Chapter 13 bankruptcy for consumers. It's the other kind of bankruptcy. It's called a Chapter 13 and accounts for the remaining 30% of people who file bankruptcies. The big thing is that under this option, you gain extra time to pay down your debts rather than to get rid of them altogether. When you file a Chapter 13 bankruptcy, you and your attorney work out a repayment plan, and that plan lasts from 3 to 5 years. And during that period, you commit to live on a sharply restricted budget so you can put as much money as possible toward repaying your debts. Your goal is to repay all your old debts during that period, but if you can't get them all paid, any remaining debt will be wiped out at the end of the repayment period, with a few exceptions. Now, under the new law, which was passed in 2005, the entire scheme was to try to get more people into Chapter 13. So more categories and tests were included that a person could be forced into a Chapter 13 if they were either close to or above the median income that a household of that person's size makes in the state in which they live. So if one is actually forced into a Chapter 13 because of the financial reality, then it's a 5-year kind of plan, 60 months that one has to be in. It can't be less than that generally. And of course, one comes up with what is actually left over both on a hypothetical standard called the means test and then on what their actual income and allowable expenses are. The means test provides a current monthly income number based on statistical tables that are both national and local for what people should be paying based on the amount of income that they have. When one goes through all of these very complex kind of computations, a number comes up at the end of it, which is a hypothetical number on what that particular household should have left over. It is then compared with the actual income and actual allowable expenses, and it then depends on what state one is in as to how that is handled. In some places, the hypothetical standard rules. In other places, the argument is that the actual rules, what is actually left over. And frankly, in some places, it becomes arguable that if the hypothetical amount is larger than the actual or vice versa, it's really the larger amount that takes over. So it may seem like the Chapter 13 is a complex and maybe challenging process to go through. However, it has a lot of advantages that can benefit an individual or family depending on their circumstances. For example, the Chapter 13 has a special advantage if one is behind on one's car payments or mortgage payments. You can get basically years to catch up through your repayment plan. So, for example, if you own your home and have fallen behind on your mortgage, the Chapter 13 may be a better bet than the Chapter 7. It provides an opportunity to catch up on the arrearages and also to put off mortgage foreclosures if one is able to catch up. Another option is that if one has filed bankruptcy, like a Chapter 7 bankruptcy, within the last 8 years, and for whatever reason is in serious financial difficulty again, a Chapter 13 can be filed 4 years after the Chapter 7 filing, even if that Chapter 7 went to discharge. So there are some benefits, and if one is in a Chapter 13 and things change, under most circumstances, one can voluntarily dismiss the Chapter 13, whereas if one is in a Chapter 7, that is not a given. One has to file a motion and ask the court, and it's not easy to get out of a Chapter 7 once one files it. So a Chapter 13 does have its advantages, and there are certain lawyers across the country who feel that it is really the way to go for a lot of people, even who are Chapter 7 kind of financial status. But you should speak to some attorney if you are in deep financial trouble, and you can get very detailed understanding of which way to go and what applies to you. So comparing a Chapter 7 and a Chapter 13, a Chapter 7 erases most of the consumer debts, whereas a Chapter 13 can erase most of the consumer debts in portion for many people, but it gives an extra time to repay even the portion that you can afford to pay. And in a Chapter 7, almost all debts are erased. Most consumer debts, such as credit cards, medical bills, payday loans, back payments on rent, utility, cell phone, etc., are all discharged. Whereas in a Chapter 13, when you first file it and go through the simple process, your debts are not immediately erased. They would not be erased until after your 3 or 5 year repayment plan. To the extent that there was any unpaid consumer debts because you owed more than you could reasonably pay, that deficiency gets discharged. Also, in a Chapter 7, there are a number of kinds of debts that never go away, such as child support, alimony, recent taxes, student loans, mortgage payments unless you give up your home, and car payments unless you give up your car. These are just examples. In a Chapter 13, you are looking at basically the same thing about debts that are never erased. Under the new law from 2005, there are some little issues here and there, but it's almost All the same, you'd have to speak to an attorney about it to see if there's something that you could do with the Chapter 13 that you could not do with the Chapter 7. The biggest advantage of a Chapter 7 is that you erase most consumer debts quickly, so you get a fresh start in a relatively short period of time. Whereas the biggest advantage of a Chapter 13 is that it gives you time to catch up on things like past mortgage payments and to pay off your debt, avoid lawsuits, and for most of the unsecured debt to stop the continued growth of that debt on interest payments and late fees and penalties, because those would stop most frequently when you have filed the Chapter 13 case. So, for example, that credit card interest doesn't keep on adding up after you file. Now, the big drawback of a Chapter 7 is that you do not have any time to catch up on the mortgage, for example, so you could lose your home. The same, of course, could be true for any secured debt, which can be dealt with in a Chapter 13 in terms of the arrearages. And unfortunately, the biggest drawback of a Chapter 13 is that many people don't actually make it through the 3 to 5 year repayment plan, and so they don't get a discharge and the debt piles back on. In other words, there are a lot of issues that you need to go through to decide what is appropriate for you, a Chapter 7 or a Chapter 13. There can be great advantages for you in one and not the other, but if you try to figure this out all by yourself, you probably are not making a completely thorough and oftentimes correct decision. And as I've been going over in the last several weeks, you may start doing things with your assets or borrowing money with your credit cards, etc., that can be harmful to you getting a discharge in bankruptcy to certain debts, or perhaps even altogether. So learn more before you do anything or make any major decision as to dealing with your debt. There are a number of really good links you can use on the internet for learning about bankruptcy in general before you even go to speak to an attorney. For example, let me give you a few of them. www.bankruptcylawnetwork.com is a blog with a lot of questions answered. You can go to the major organization, NACBA, at www.nacba.org/tips to learn about debt problems, and that's the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys. Or besides the links, you can go to one very good book called the NCLC Guide to Surviving Debt. And that's America's Consumer Law Experts, the National Consumer Law Center. In short, there are a lot of learning options that you can investigate. But then at some point, you certainly do want to speak with an attorney, particularly one who is a specialist in the field of debt relief and bankruptcy. And next week, we will look into more on how it all works when you are jumping over the line into a Chapter 7 or Chapter 13 bankruptcy. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life. You are listening to the open source sounds of Wicked All Stars. The song is Jazz House from the album Dark Clouds, available from Magnatune.